You're listening to Make It Thrive, the company culture podcast. I'm your host, Lizzie Benton, culture coach and founder of Liberty Mind, and I want to inspire people to change the way we think about work so our human potential can thrive. In this podcast, I speak to experts, thought leaders, founders, and curious explorers, all dedicated to shifting the world of work. Together, we can make it thrive. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Make It Thrive, where this season we're making the intangible more tangible. And it seems that many of the conversations are resonating with you this season, as I've been tagged in a few social posts with episodes that you've connected with. So first of all, thank you, because it really does mean a lot when people share these episodes or recommend the podcast. It just really makes it feel like the conversations are going further. And second of all, keep the feedback coming, because I would love to know more about what you want to hear more of so that I can begin to shape season 13, which will come out in the autumn. So whether it's hearing from more progressive organizations about how they work, or whether you want me to get more experts on particular topics, do let me know, because it really is about opening up our language around work and the possibilities that we have. So on today's episode, some of you regular listeners will have already met this guest, but when a guest is so good, all I want to do is just keep bringing them back. And I suppose it's a little greedy of me, but I can't help it. There are just some people in this world who aren't only easy to talk to, but always bring such a fresh perspective and are so generous with their knowledge and wisdom and practical expertise. And this guest is certainly one of those special people. Someone, in fact, you know, when you think about people who you'd love to have over as part of like a dinner party setup, then this guest is definitely at the top of my dinner party list. And today I'm joined by Nick Marks, workplace happiness expert, statistician, I hope I've said that right, and TEDx speaker and founder of Friday Pulse. Nick and I spoke all the way back in season 9, where we got talking about workplace data and insights and how they can be used. So if you're eager to learn more about workplace happiness surveys, specifically employee engagement and things like that, then I'd highly recommend going back to that season. However, today we're talking about Nick's favorite topic, happiness. After all, aren't we all just wanting to be happier at work? In this episode, Nick shares what he's learned so far as he begins to prepare his book on happiness and some of the surprising elements of happiness that go missed. So let's dive in.
Hi, Nick, and welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having on again, Lizzie.
I can't believe that I had you last on 4 years ago. That feels like it's gone far too quickly.
4 years ago. So we were in the throes of COVID.
We were in the throes of COVID, 2020, July 2020, in fact.
Yeah. God, that was a weird time.
So tell me, what has been going on since 2020? What's new, Nick?
I still have a business, which I'm sure lots of people don't. So that's good. But it definitely slowed things down. I've been working on a book, actually, is what I've been doing for the last year and a bit. It's taking me some time, but it's there. It's getting there. It's got a full draft and it's with a publisher at the moment. So that's very exciting.
Amazing. Are you able to kind of give us a little hint of anything that might be in the book?
Absolutely. No problem. So it's called Happiness is a Serious Business. And basically it is why we should take happiness at work seriously. Why that's good for us, why it's good for our teams, and why it's good for organizations. If I even go a little bit into why it's good for society, but that's just a sort of extra bit.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. I love the fact that you're also tapping into that bit about society as well and kind of how it bleeds out into all those different aspects. But for those listening, have you kind of coined your own definition for happiness?
Oh, well, I basically take the view that happiness is the best word to use, because we don't ask our friends, how is your well-being? We don't ask them, you know, how engaged are you? And, you know, we don't ask them how satisfied you are in life. We ask how happy you are. So this is the very natural language of how we use it. So I'm a statistician, as you know, and so when I'm measuring stuff, if people understand what you mean by what you're asking, then they're going to give you more robust data. So if I ask people how happy are you at work, they give a much better answer than how engaged are you or what your well-being is. So so in that way, I just think it's a very natural language. But yeah, I mean, I don't really get into defining happiness, but more into what happiness is, and it's a very functional positive emotion. And that helped, that has helped us survive and thrive through the millennia. So it's critical to human functioning. And it's a signal in a way of good fit, that when we're in an environment that we're a good fit for, we feel happy. So you can go right back to Darwin and, you know, evolutionary theory about that. You know, good fit is critical. So but of course, good fit isn't static. It's always moving. It's very dynamic. You know, it can be from both internal and external things that we're less of a good fit. So we can get less happy just simply because we're hungry or we haven't moved our body. We can get less happy, I mean, profound reasons, like we're in the wrong relationship for us or something like that. So there's different profundities to the happiness, but happiness in a way is a signal of good fit. And it is also motivational, in that when we feel good at work, we do good work. You know, when we're happy in life, we attract people around us. So it's very functional too.
I'm definitely one of those people in the unhappy when hungry, the hangry group, as they call it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, actually, work. This is actually really important, because, you know, obviously what the employer wants is productivity or, you know, good work, isn't it? And that doesn't mean just individually, that means collectively. So that's teamwork, it's all sorts of things. But you know, we can, our attention can drift or focus, and some of that is internal, you know. And it's like people say, you know, it isn't true, but people do say sitting is the new smoking. There's no way that it's as big an impact as smoking. There is a psychological thing that is, but not sitting. But you know, if you sit too long, you get stiff and you're not going to do your best work. So getting up and moving. And the thing that is as big as smoking, in effect, that's come through recently in public health data, is loneliness. Which is that loneliness is probably as big a risk factor as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Yeah, which is just, I mean, yeah, when you put it like that, that's phenomenal amount of statistics, yeah. Isn't it? And do you think, in terms of that happiness, because when you were talking there about loneliness and also about the fact that happiness is something that is, you know, like a wave, you know, we have these moments of where we need to kind of shift and change things, because what made us happy at one point might not make us happy at another point. Do you feel like people are a bit more connected to their sense of happiness since COVID? Because I feel like that time gave us so much reflection and kind of introspection that we're maybe becoming maybe slightly more heightened to what we need now.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think none of us came out of COVID unchanged in some way. And I mean, it does feel a bit more distant now, doesn't it? 4 years on, but
yeah.
Well, not four, actually, it's only 2.5 years on, really, isn't it? Because really, COVID only ended in the summer of 2021, when we had the vaccines and stuff. Really, it started to become less of a threat. But I think we're seeing generational shifts. I think we're seeing, you know, this, the data coming out recently that many more young people are taking mental health breaks from work and. So there's definitely something going on, and I'm not in the view that this is derogatory and snowflakey and everything. I think this is actually that my generation, you know, I'm a lot older than you, put up with too much, if I might say, shit at work for too long. You know, I think we, you know, if I think of my first jobs, I was working 50, 60 hour weeks. I was, you know, quite hyped about it, but you know, didn't leave much room for relationships, didn't leave much room for other stuff, you know. So my kids, who are all in their 20s, one was 30 last weekend, so okay, one's in 30 now, but you know, but they are they're much more practical about their work-life balance than ever I was when I was young. So I think there's some really good shifts there. And yeah, I would say people are more thinking about their experience of life. You know, we talk about moving to an experience economy, away from a, you know, consumption-based economy to an experience-based economy. And I think we have that going on in our lives and our work, and people are prioritizing that more. I mean, there's lots of other things going on there with the younger generation. The price, you know, housing pricing means that they actually don't have the hope to sort of build that life that we were sold, you know, buy a house, get on there, you know, get a good job, you know. So I think they go much more pragmatically. Well, what am I going to do this year? What am I going to do this tonight? You know, and I that's not a bad thing necessarily.
Yeah, gosh, that's so true, isn't it? I think it's really interesting when we think about, because I was talking to someone the other day, actually, and it's even the in the news, you know, they were talking about how a lot of pubs and nightclubs are closing because that's no longer really a thing, and actually we are experiencing a slight shift in how we socialize, and you know, even the, you know, being sober is now such a big trend. You know, alcohol in itself is becoming less of a drinking culture as well, so it's almost like I feel like there is a shift to a much more healthier, well-being focused, I suppose, society more than anything. And I think that has to be then reflected in the workplace.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there. I mean, I think good that we're drinking less and more sober. My generation, I think, was probably the most drunk generation ever. And maybe, I don't know. But you know, I think that's good. I definitely... No, I mean, you still, obviously still people still do use alcohol, but it is getting less. And I think wellbeing is becoming much more of a focus, and at work you can see it coming up. You know, like if you there was a really good study, I'm pretty sure it's by George Ward, who's at MIT. Do you know his work?
Anyway,
I think it was by him, and it was basically he works with Indeed, the job board. And Indeed now have, you can fill in a happiness at work survey when you go and apply for a job. And they are looking at like what people are looking for at work. And if you ask people, what do they think is a happy job? Work-life balance becomes the number one thing that they say. It actually, happy job, work-life balance is in there. But for a happy job, it's much more about being... No, it's not much more. It's a bit more about being treated fairly and then also being inspired. Those two things are the biggest drivers. And work-life balance is part, I think, of being treated fairly. But so there's definitely people thinking about it. Like my, you know, I mean, part of my touching with the young generations is my kids, and my youngest is a qualified accountant and not enjoying it. And so thinking, what am I going to do? He's not going to put up with being on audits, which he's not enjoying. He's thinking, okay, what do I want to do instead? And that's good, particularly before you've got used to too high a salary, because if you get too into having too high a salary and make a whole lifestyle around it, then you get trapped in that. So actually, I think it's very good while you're younger to try lots of things, you know, and find out what you really enjoy doing. Because how can you know? I mean, it's ridiculous to think at 18, school can tell you what you're going to do. I don't think I found out what I wanted to do until I was about 40, you know. And then, you know, and even now I'm still finding, you know, new things. Or no, I'm sort of focusing in on the bits of work that I really enjoy. So, yeah, I think you have to get to learn and experimenting and thinking about how much you enjoy it and how it fits with your lifestyle is really, really important.
Oh gosh, yeah, there's so much more to consider. It's like back in the day when you used to go to the careers office and you used to have to talk about what you wanted to do. You know, no one actually asked you what was going to make you happy.
No.
It's like no one ever kind of, you know, gave you some experiences to go and sort of test the waters. I mean, you know, work experience was extremely limited even when I was at school. You know, you could maybe go and work in a shop or something. So even the careers available to you to go and try out were extremely limited. But I suppose one thing that interests me, Nick, is in terms of, you know, kind of happiness, it, you know, we often see it because this season is all about kind of making the intangible more tangible. And what would you say when we think about happiness, comes to your mind as things that are really tangible that we can measure happiness by?
Yeah, people often say, oh, happiness is intangible and you can't measure it. And I would actually say it's more tangible than well-being and engagement, because it's more easy to understand. And actually, it's definitely easier to create measures of. I'm not going to say you measure happiness. And happiness is this rich, multidimensional human experience. But you can create useful measures of it, you know. And there's a very old Chinese saying or proverb, which is that the finger that points to the moon is not the moon. And when I create measures, they're fingers pointing to happiness. Okay, they're not happiness. So let's just bear that in mind. But then, you know, if you ask people, yeah, how happy are you at work, they can give you an answer that's quite vague. If you get more specific and you go, how happy were you at work this week? Oh, you can give an answer, definitely. And so my way of making happiness more tangible is to time bound it very tightly in my measurement. And then you get something very useful, because we all have good and bad weeks. And actually, one of the things with happiness is it's such a desirable thing. Mm-hmm. That to say you're not happy at work in general is like fairly destroying. Whereas to say you've had a bad week is actually quite easy. And I find that in my data. So, you know, I do population surveys from time to time. Basically, we create benchmarks for our clients to so they can see how they're doing against different sectors. And I use population surveys because our clients are inevitably biased. They're already ones that are interested in happiness, so we can't say that they're representative. And included in that, I will ask people at the beginning of the survey about how happy are they at work overall, because I use that in all of my equations and my correlation coefficients. But then I'll do a section on their week last week, and fewer people will say they were happy. These are the same people in the survey. Fewer people will say they were happy last week than say they're happy overall. And that's to be expected, because it's a lower stakes question. And so, and it also is more specific. And that's actually better data, because if you run a business, if you lead a team, you actually want to know how people are right now quite a lot, because that's where their motivation is and that's where they are. And also for us as individually, if we say, and this is really feasible to do, that I enjoy my job, but I'm miserable every week because it's too stressed. And that sounds like a, but it actually is quite possible, because you might love the image of the job. You might love the status it gives you. You might love the money that it gives you, but actually your experience is bad. Then actually you should wake up to that. And, you know, and sometimes there's a misconnect between those two points. And that can be that. Doesn't only have to be at work, that can be in your relationships. You know, you can love being in a relationship, you can love the idea of being in a relationship, your family can love your partner. But if you're not happy day to day, sometime you've got to wake up to that. Yeah. And that's, of course, a painful experience to get, but it's a critical one for our growth, for everything. So it's the same at work, you know. So so actually knowing how people feel on a week-to-week basis, it could be a month-to-month basis, I think is really, really important. Mm. And it makes it more tangible.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, even we all have bad weeks, right? Even if you work for yourself. Yeah. Am I always happily self-employed? No.
I mean, generally the statistics on self-employed is they're less happy than those that work in teams, but it depends how much collaboration you have in your work. And of course there's flexibility that comes with working for yourself, which have you got kids?
I don't, not yet.
No, but I mean, people who have kids, you know, love it. Or, you know, there's lots of reasons to be, you know, the independence, the autonomy. Mm. But you can miss that social motivation and support that comes from working in a team. And this is one of the big issues with work from home and work in the office. You know, the tension there is that in the short term, it can feel really good working from home. And home is a happy place, so we feel working from home is more likely to be happy than working in the office. Office work is considered, you know, in our subconscious at least, as hard and difficult and not as enjoyable as life. So working from home feeds into some desirability biases, but also it's true, it's lovely to have the flexibility, but then you miss out a little on that team spirit, and that's really important to you know, and it's very important to our happiness at work.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, Nick, about how well-being often kind of gets kind of shimmied into this happiness. But really, well-being is very different to happiness. And that sometimes, you know, what we've seen a lot of the time is that well-being programs don't always work. Like, people enjoy the experience of, say, going to a mindfulness workshop, but that it doesn't have like that lasting impact. So what would you say when it comes to, like, do we need to segregate happiness and well-being, and how would you explain that to an organization?
So look, I've loved the word happiness. I mean, word well-being. I love the word happiness. I mean, I set up a center for well-being in 2001 at a think tank in London and did policy work on it. Well-being is kind of a made up word. You know, it's not quite, but it's kind of a, you know, it definitely feels unemotional. There's no emotional tone to it. Happiness is a great emotional tone to it. Well-being, you know, sounds a bit serious, which of course is precisely why when I was doing government work, we use the word well-being, because it can be taken more seriously. And I think it's the same in businesses. I think in larger corporates, you're going to see chief well-being officers much more than you will chief happiness officers, you know, because it sounds more serious. But it doesn't inspire, does it, as a word? And it's like, and it's also ill-defined, you know, like, is it my physical well-being? Is it my mental well-being? My emotional well-being, some people talk about. My spiritual well-being, people will say, you know, well, you know, happiness is kind of, we get, because it is actually just naturally human, you know. And I think some of adopting the word well-being is a kind of fear to go into the emotional, you know, that there's, it feels safer to talk about well-being. Yeah. And then if you look at the data on well-being programs, it's not so much that they're well-being programs, it's the way they're designed to be individually based. Mm-hmm. So I know what you're talking about the paper by, I think he's called William Fleming, isn't he? He's definitely called Fleming, from Oxford University, who came out last year. And he assessed, when he looked at this large survey of Britain's healthiest workplaces, so these are already workplaces interested in health, so there's a bias in the sample, but it's a positive bias towards well-being. So, and he looked at all the programs they did, whether they gave people well-being apps, whether they did mindfulness training, resilience training, all sorts of things. And he looked at the impact of them, and there was none. In fact, the resilience training was detrimental to their mental health. And for me, it was a small negative effect. But basically, if you've got an organization and you're stressing people out, and if your response is go on a resilience training because it's your responsibility to deal with it, that's pretty unethical in lots of ways. The one intervention that had a positive thing was when organizations that give volunteering opportunities to people. But that's actually not dealing with their work at all. That's giving them something to go outside of work, where they're doing something social and indeed pro-social. So really what his paper was saying was not so much that well-being is bad, but that individually based interventions do not have a return on investment. So don't pretend they do. You can do them if you want to. Yeah. If you want to, you know, it's like gym membership at work. You know, actually the only people that take it up are people that would go to the gym in their home life. So you're not really, you're just saving them a cost. It's a benefit. It's not actually a positive intervention. And I think the same for mindfulness, I'm afraid, is that I think the people who go to mindfulness training at work, they would be doing it in their private life anyway. They're just doing it at work. So it's not actually, and it's not solving the, you know, the social structure of work, which is actually where the problems are. You know, people's experience of work is very proximal. It's very close to the work they're working on, the people that they work with. It's their day-to-day, week-to-week work that is the biggest impact. So if you're making interventions, I don't mind whether you call them happiness or well-being, but they do need to be systematic and they do need to be social. So they're not individually based, and they need to bring people together in some way. And if I would add a third S, which is simple. I think they need to be actually, because work is busy. So if you're going to do things which take a lot of time that aren't easy to do throughout an organization, you're unlikely to get much to take up from it either.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was what was so profound about the research, because, you know, in the past we've seen so many, and I mean, and especially during the height of the pandemic, we saw such a push for wellbeing programs and wellbeing incentives. But like I say, it doesn't actually go to the root cause of, you know, what's actually causing the stress or the pressure or the unhappiness. And it is very kind of like, oh, it's not, you know, it's not the company's problem. It's a you problem.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing that's coming through in the research, which is spectacularly good and is not called a happiness intervention or a wellbeing intervention, but is getting data which is showing that it has a huge impact, is 4-day week. Which I've got a chapter in my book, which at the moment is called, the second half of my book is less fully written, but it's called The Most Radical Intervention, because it's obviously not going to be for every organization. But, you know, they've got data on over 200 companies moving to a 4-day week. And so if you think about that research I said about William Fleming, where he's showing there's no impact and there's a small positive impact of volunteering. Well, this is a huge impact on people's well-being, you know, their happiness, well-being. However they measured it, they measured it obviously with work-life balance, but they measured it with, you know, mental health scales. They measured it with job satisfaction, job happiness scales. Every single measure was a massive effect size. And in fact, I need to do this analysis in this, and I haven't done it yet, but in the William Fleming one, you can basically see, it's called a Z score, but basically a Z score is how many standard deviations you've improved or not. And you also have a standard error, the mean around that, you can see what it has in effect. And I must put these in the same graph, but basically they dwarf it. They dwarf it so positively. So it would dwarf the volunteering one. But I mean, from my top of my head, and I haven't done that, I think it's about a move of half a standard deviation up in people's well-being. And that's a massive, massive impact. So, you know, normally you're looking at a 0.1, 0.2 change to be quite good. So it's a really big... Now, they have to do it in a way that doesn't negatively impact productivity, profitability of the business and everything. But basically, of all these companies, you know, over 92% stayed with the 4-day week afterwards. And most of the ones that didn't had a change of ownership or senior leadership, i.e. the people that introduced it were not the now people running it. And they basically went, right, we're going to go back to where we are. So they come in with, you know, a new CEO comes in or new finance comes in. And no, we're not doing that. You know, that's ridiculous. Even though there's evidence that the basically the idea of these 4-day weeks is what they call 180-100, which is that you get 100% of the productivity for 80% of the hours. And I can't remember what the other 100% is, but it's 180-100 anyway. And so they're basically trying to you know, protect the output, but and give a real benefit to staff. Now, this doesn't mean every company needs to go to a 4-day week, but be very aware that people will be happier with more leisure time rather than more money.
Yeah.
So, you know, the tip would be, if you're offering bonuses, you could offer them in extra days off. You could offer them in different ways. Or you can, you know, not go to a 4-day week, but go to, a 9-day fortnight, or the last Friday in the month off, or we finish at lunchtime on a Friday. Whatever, you could do things like that and you will get more out of your employees.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we all want that sense of flexibility and autonomy over how we can kind of plan our days and our weeks. And yeah, we've seen obviously such a huge rise in, you know, people either mandating return to office or that kind of thing, you know, being very rigid and restrictive about how people work again, now that we're kind of going back to sort of in quotes, more normal ways of working. But really, like you said, the data is out there that actually, if we can try and create more alternative ways of working that work with people rather than against them, it really is a win-win situation rather than a win-lose situation. I know I found a really interesting video from Rory Sutherland the other day, and he was talking about, you know, sometimes companies are not linking happiness with productivity. So they seem to think that if people are happy, then the company must be doing something wrong. Because it's like, you know, he was talking about in reference to the return to office mandates and how, you know, we've got all these other things that we want, you know, emails and such that we're kind of quite happy with that are still very unproductive. But, you know, if people are happy with something, does that mean we're doing something wrong? Like, it's almost like they're you know, taking too much. I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that, Nick.
Yeah, you sent me that video and it made me laugh. I do like Rory Sutherland. He just somehow creates a narrative that's just sort of very, very compelling. And so I think that this is the fear of senior leaders. And I look at this, I'm a statistician, I look at this two variables. One variable is how happy or not a team is, and the other is whether they're low or high performing. And you can put that in a 2x2 quadrant. And basically what you want is happy, high performing teams. So they are great teams, they're top right of the quadrant. What you absolutely don't want is miserable teams, which are low performing and unhappy. But you've got two other quadrants there. And the quadrant they're frightened of is the happy, low performing. And that I call that slacking teams, or it could be coasting. But, you know, and that's the fear. What people have got much more of is the bottom right, which is burning out teams, where they actually are quite high performing. They're driving results, but they're driving people out of the business. So they've got much higher staff turnover, much higher rates of burnout in that bottom quadrant than they have in the great team quadrant. So if you want to, reduce staff turnover, then happiness is an absolutely massive impact in it. If you are worried about slacking teams, really, that's your business goals that you haven't got set. You haven't got, you know, those tight enough. And so, because you can you actually have very few teams in that slacking quadrant. They can exist. They do exist, because there's not a perfect correlation between performance and happiness. That would be mad if it was, but it's a strong correlation. So you can definitely see ones in the other quadrants, but there are far more in the burning out quadrant than there are in the slacking quadrant. Probably 4 times as many teams down there as there are in the slacking. So you've got to keep an eye out for that, but that's not criticism of happiness, because many more happy teams are in that quadrant of being high performing. So, you know, six or seven times as many happy teams are in the high performing rather than the slacking. So it's something to watch out for, but it's not the main thing. And, you know, and it's the cynicism of senior leaders. And it's, you know, that actually, you know, that they sort of got to grind out performance rather than inspire people. And I think it shows a lack of awareness around it. But I mean, that's part of the business case of my book, which is that happy employees are worth so much more to you. Mm. And the reason they are is that they are more productive, which is great, but they stay longer. And those two amplify the effect. So we often talk about the lifetime value of a customer. But if you look at the lifetime value of an employee, what it costs you, just like a customer, costs you something to acquire an employee. You have to train them. You have to onboard them. So there's costs right at the beginning. And then it takes time for them to pay back that cost. And then you're in credit with them, because presumably they're making more value than their salary. If they're not, you've got a business problem. So, you know, sort of adding more and more value of time. But if a happy employee stays, the average tenure in the UK is about 5 years. A happy employee's average tenure is 7 years. So they're staying 2 years longer. They're being more productive all along. And if you do the maths of it, they have over 2.2 times the lifetime value of an okay employee. An unhappy employee, you've hardly got any value in, because basically they've left you quickly. They haven't added anything when they're there. So then we all make bad hiring decisions, but it actually makes it really important to get good fit for who you employ. Really, really important. So it's worth investing there. And then you need to make sure they're good fit in their teams. Yeah. And that the indicator of good fit in teams is happiness. Yeah. That is the best indicator of good fit that you have. And it's easy. And you can ask everybody, because it can go across every role. You know, you can ask a janitor if they're happy. You can ask a CEO. If they are a good fit for their role and they're enjoying it, they're going to be happy. So it's the biggest indicator that predicts the value of an employee. Mm. So it's massive, the effect.
Yeah. Well, I feel like you've answered my question, because at the start of this whole podcast, I was like, how do you sell the business case for happiness? But there it is. I mean, that data is you know, we all know it as common sense, but when you put it in that way, Nick, and you kind of explain the data around those differing, you know, unhappy and happy employees, I think, you know, businesses would be, it would be nonsense not to invest in happiness and to understand how we create more happiness within teams.
Yeah. And I mean, like every investment decision, there's going to be an optimal level.
Yeah.
You know, is it, you know, you so... You know, don't, I mean, you know, you can keep spending money on your individual well-being programs. You're not going to make people happy. So you're not going to get, so look where you're going to get a return. And the return is ultimately, really, when it gets down to it, is having the essential people skills at your management level. That, because ultimately the team leader, the team manager is going to have a big impact on all of their team. And so making sure they've got the support for the right people skills, and they've got the time to spend with their team. So the time to get the team together every week to talk about how the last week, the time to have their individual one-to-ones, the time to look after the development of each of their team. You know, and too often people are promoted for their technical skills or their length of service rather than their people skills. Well, create other promotion tracks for those things. But promotion tracks for management jobs should be based on people skills.
Yeah, we've seen a huge, I think that gap between, you know, people skills and technical skills has really started to come into play over kind of the recent years, as we've seen that kind of trajectory of people, you know, promoted because of their technical ability, but actually management requires different skills to the doing of the job.
You're actually going to make them worse at their role because they won't enjoy the people side of it, and they'll be frustrated they can't do their more technical work. So just pay them lots of money for doing their technical work and praise them and appreciate them for what they do and create a career path for them that way. You know, and they could maybe mentor people about their technical skills, but don't get them to be their line manager, their, you know, their mentor in how they want to develop their career or how they get the best out of it. You know, create different structures for that. That doesn't seem rocket science to me. And, you know, the Chartered Management Institute estimate that 80% of managers are what they call accidental in the UK. They've got absolutely no training and they're sort of promoted for other reasons. It's no wonder we've got a productivity slump in this country, you know. Though, to be fair, it's not much different in the US. I don't know whether specifically you, but those are the only two countries I've got good data on it. But I don't know whether in Europe they invest in it more, but it would seem that that would be, we should be investing much more in helping people be good fit in their teams, which means having good support, good management. And management's not only support, it's challenge too. Let's not forget that. That actually good managers stretch their employees. They don't just make it all lovely for them. Stretch is really important in development. Actually, you know, we actually are creatures that like to be challenged and like to have stretch and like to achieve goals. So work with that energy. You know, so it's not all about just, you know, having nice. I mean, I sometimes say it's not about pizza and ping pong and party. Those are perfectly nice, but it's about how we work together. That's really, really where it's at.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So someone listening to this then, Nick, I mean, you've given some very practical takeaways of elements and where businesses can, you know, invest their time and energy. But are there any other things where if someone was listening to this and they want to start looking at happiness, where you would kind of direct them to start taking some action?
Yeah. So if you're a team leader, I think really concentrate on the weekly experience of your team members. So think of the friction and flow. What's frustrating them? What are they really loving doing? Build on the positives, tackle the negatives. The methodology that I use as a statistician, so that is systematic, that is social, that is simple, is I call measure, meet, repeat, which is basically on a Friday, measure how people's experience was. On a Monday, meet and talk about it, repeat that process. And that's a weekly cycle. And that's what my Business Friday Pulse has a platform that helps support that. But there's also a longer cycle, which is basically reflecting on the sort of drivers of it. And if you want to understand how I think about the drivers of team happiness, then we've got a free tool, which is just called FridayOne.com. And you can go there and it'll give you a personal happiness test and it will show you the drivers of happiness at work and get you reflecting on it. And if you like it and you want to use it with your team, then there's a free team version of Friday Pulse for teams of 11 and under people. And the reason it's 11 rather than 10 is that a football team's 11. So for me, that's the largest team that can function as one. Because by the time you go to rugby, they split into two groups, American football into like three or four groups, you know. So 11 is about the biggest team that can function. So that's what our free team version is about. So for me, it's about driving a simple process. It's about creating habits in your team every week, you know. And, you know, I've got whole sections on the book about that, and we're not going to get into them today, but it's so rewarding to lead a happy team. I mean, leading an unhappy team is just terrible, you know, because you know it's not right. You don't know what to do. Leading a happy team is great because they're going to love and respect you, and they're going to do that together, and they're going to get that synergy, which you need where, you know, in a team, the reason that we work in teams is it's better than working individually. Yeah. You know, ideas build on each other. They, you know, people add different perspectives. That's why some diversity in your teams is good as well, you know, of ages and, you know, and genders and even race and whatever like that, but different perspectives. It's really important because then you get a better response. That can be difficult sometimes. You know, happy team doesn't have to always be happy. That doesn't sound mad. You know, it's like there's gonna be some challenge in there. That's okay. That's respect in some ways. You know, I respect you enough that I'm gonna disagree with you.
Yeah.
That's you know, it's like that's what you want. That's what you want at work, you know. But you know, obviously don't want everyone to just negatively disagrees with you all the time, but you know, you want to be honest with each other. It's like a relationship again, you know, taking it back to that. You know, it's great when your partner will challenge you on things. You know, that's a good thing to have, you know, but clearly you want to be supported by them too. So there's a tension there always, but yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Nick. And when can we expect the book to come out, Nick? Because we're going to be tentatively waiting.
Well, I post on LinkedIn a lot, so a lot of the content is going to be out on LinkedIn before the book comes out. So follow me on LinkedIn, and Nick is without a K, so I'm very easy to find. NIC Marks, and it's just left over from childhood, but it's quite convenient. And then it will be mid 2025. So at the moment, it's finding a publisher, it's with an agent. But I'm told that even when I deliver the manuscript, it's going to be 12 months. So,
The
second half of it, although all the ideas are there, I'm rewriting it at the moment. So it will be mid 2025. But, you know, I'm going to get out speaking about it before. But, you know, I'm quite imagining, hoping that, you know, it will reignite my ability to speak because this is my passion. Yeah. You know, it's been my life is about how do you improve people's lives. And I do that with statistics. That's my little way into it. And there's lots of other ways into it. It's not the only way, but that's my contribution. So I'm very excited about it because I offer measurement tools for organizations. And I, you know, one thing I haven't said is like when I was young, I trained as a therapist, and therapy is really a reflective process. And I think of statistics in the same way, is that they raise and bring into awareness what's going on. You can reflect and act better. Yeah. And so that's my approach to measurement of happiness at work.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Nick, for spending some time with us today and for how practical you've been as well. I feel like there's so much people can take away, and it's kind of given a really refreshing lens on happiness, I think. And I certainly feel like there's been a refreshed take on happiness. So thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Make It Thrive, the company culture podcast, with me, your host, Lizzie Benton. If you've enjoyed listening and want to keep up with all things culture, don't forget to subscribe. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to welcoming you back next week.